Welcome to Flagler in Focus, the podcast where we dive deep into all things Flagler County. I'm your host, Karen Callahan, and with each podcast, we'll explore the people, places, and events of our community, from interviews with local experts, community leaders, and fabulous folks with stories to tell. We're your go-to source for staying connected to what's happening in Flagler County. And today we have with us Ralph Risch, our Flagler County Forestry Supervisor from our Land Management Department. Greetings, Ralph.
Good afternoon.
How are you
today? I'm doing well today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. So, Ralph, why don't we start with introducing yourself to our listeners?
Okay. Again, my name is Ralph Risch. I'm the Forestry Supervisor for Flagler County, which basically means I go and I count trees because that's what forestry supervisors do since I supervise no one but myself. Well, it's, you know, it's got to keep myself in line.
Exactly.
Make sure I'm doing my job. So what I do is I go out and we have stands of property that have timber on them. Mm-hmm. And mostly for ecological purposes, we need to thin that timber, which means partial cut of it, so that it can be more ecologically sound. Now, a lot of Flagler County properties were acquired long after they had been planted with rows and rows of various pine species. And sometimes that pine species is appropriate for the habitat. Sometimes it's not, because a lot of them were done in the past. But they need to be thin for one reason or another. So I go out there and I do an inventory of the trees on there by taking sample plots. And then using that data, I calculate the volume of the timber out there and the mass of it, and therefore the value that we might be able to get if we were to sell various proportions of it. And that is my primary focus of my job and position, but actually I'm kind of a polymath. I do all sorts of stuff. My original training, once I got out of the Army, that is, was I went to State University of New York in Plattsburgh, New York, for environmental science and ecology, and I got my degree in that in 1991. And then I've worked at a variety of field biology jobs across the country since then, until 2006 when I, in 1996, I went off to graduate school at the University of South Florida for zoology degree, and I got most of that, but unfortunately I wasn't able to finish for several reasons. And then I continued on with various jobs in field biology until 2006 when I got a job with the Florida Forest Service as the Florida scrub jay biologist for Seminole State Forest in Lake County. And I was there at that job for 16 years until 2022, September 2022, when I came here to Flagler County to be the forestry supervisor.
Oh, so you've been there here that long?
Yes, I've been there here for 2.5 years now. Yeah, I know. Sorry, guys. I know you're hoping I would leave. I wouldn't stay around that long, but nevertheless, I'm still here. You're going to have to live with it. And the first thing they made me do when I got here was that hurricane came through. What was
that? Which one?
The first
2002?
One. 2002? The first one in 2022, whatever it was.
In 2022?
2022, yeah. They took
Ian, Nicole?
Yeah, it could have been Ian. Ian or Nicole, I don't know, whatever, whichever one it was. And so they stuck me into the EOC, Emergency Operations Center, cold. And I'm like, okay, well, this is fun. I have no experience in this. Yay. Yay.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, you're our resident biologist. And actually, we had a little bit of trouble getting you. We wanted to get you on the podcast, but I know we've been doing a series of, you know, you're in charge, you take part in our controlled burns. So can you tell listeners a little bit about that?
Well, land management is a department that has a variety of functions. One of them, of course, is the timber function, which I have. We also have to maintain the natural lands that are owned by Flagler County, which is over 10,000 acres. I think it's close to 11,000 acres right now, maybe a little bit more.
Wow.
They're either owned by it, Flagler County, or leased by it, depending. Like, for example, Graham Swamp has 3,400 acres, but Flagler County doesn't actually own that property. It's actually owned by the St. Johns River Water Management District and leased us for management purposes.
Okay.
Which makes sense, because if you have some properties, let's say you're an entity, Flagler County, you have a certain number of properties, and they're kind of broken up in little chunks here and there, and they border another property that's another ecologically focused property, another natural lands, and it's owned by someone else. Well, either you have to manage both of them separately or you manage them both together. Mm-hmm. If you're going to manage them both together, it's better to have one entity managing it. And so this is what happens is a lot of the properties that we have are officially owned by other entities, either State of Florida, St. John's River Water Management District, and so forth. But we have the management responsibility for it. So they're essentially transferred to us for all management purposes.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain the importance of controlled burns and why we do them?
Most Florida upland habitats are fire dependent, not just fire prone, mm-hmm. but fire dependent, as in for the habitat to be maintained in an ecologically healthy manner, it has to have periodic fire. That fire can vary in time between when you burn it from 2 years to some areas of flatwoods and sandhill mm-hmm. between natural fire to much longer distance. Like, for example, scrub varies between 10 and 16 years before it would naturally have a burn. And some areas of a hydric hammock or lowland hammock would maybe 50 mm-hmm. or 60 years between burns. Some swamps almost never burn. But typically you find that in the upland areas of habitat, flatwoods, sandhill, scrubby flatwoods, things like that, the typical burn interval natural fire would be between 2 and 16 years, depending mm-hmm. on the type. Well, we don't want lots of wildfires
yes.
burning around the edge of the E section or the Q section. Or, yeah, people would get very unhappy about that.
Yes,
And I wouldn't blame them, but yeah. still, you have to do it because mm-hmm. the other aspect of it is because they burn naturally within these periods of time, mm-hmm. under natural conditions, you don't have a whole lot of fuel in there,
mm-hmm.
right? So if, let's say, a particular habitat burns once every 4 years and it's, mesic flatwoods. Mesic means in between, which has okay. means a middle amount of water in it. So mesic
okay.
flatwoods, you'll get, from the pines, you'll get needle casts. So the needles will fall on the ground and they'll build up.
Mm-hmm.
And you have palmettos, and so the palmetto fronds die and they build up. Well, if you burn them every 4 years, that almost all of that goes,
mm-hmm.
right? And so every time there's a fire, there's only 4 years worth of fuel.
Okay.
All right? Let's say you let that sit there for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you have five times the amount of fuel.
Oh.
A fire comes through then, it has a lot more fuel, it burns a lot hotter,
mm-hmm.
it'll kill a lot more trees, and more importantly, it will burn much longer and much more heavily. And if it's next to a neighborhood or something,
mm-hmm.
those houses are going to go.
Oh.
So you look at what happened in California,
yeah.
that's exactly the problem they have. They were doing no prescribed fire in those areas because people didn't want it. People didn't like the smell of smoke. They didn't like to see the fire, blah, blah, blah. The neighborhoods were planned poorly. They were put in steep canyons with chaparral brush right next to it, which never burned.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you have all this fuel because it's not being prescribed fire. You have all this fuel buildup. So when the fires do hit, there's so much of it, the firefighters can't keep it out of the neighborhoods.
Mm.
This is what happened in Maui. The same thing happened in, what was the name of the community there a couple of years ago? I can't remember.
I don't remember.
It was this big fire a couple of years ago that would kill 50 some odd people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing. There was tons and tons of fuel adjacent to natural fuel, meaning grasses and stuff. In fact, it was a particularly invasive species of grass that was growing everywhere called the guinea grass
okay.
that no one did anything about. And so when the fire came and the winds blew, there was nothing to stop it because there was too much fuel. So it's important for us to do these prescribed burns, not just for ecological restoration, but mm-hmm. for fuel reduction too. So
okay.
in the event that a wildfire happens, and wildfires will happen, don't doubt it. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter where you are. Someday a lightning strike is going to hit a tree right mm-hmm. at the end of the dry season when there's no rain and there's going to be a strong wind and there will be a wildfire in every single one of these upland mm-hmm. communities eventually. And if there's less fuel there, the neighborhoods are safer. If there's more fuel there, they're not as safe.
So over in California, I remember some of the voices when they were saying the reasons why, you know, improper planning for said wildfires was because they wanted to protect certain species or what have you. Is that a concern that we have here when we prepare for these controlled burns?
It is always a concern because you have to be careful of what you're doing. For
mm-hmm.
example, if you have an area of flatwoods and there are gopher tortoises in there. Mm-hmm. And you decide you want to remove some of the palmettos and fuel. Well, you go in there with heavy equipment. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't want to do it when the gopher tortoises are out and above ground because you're going to squish them. Mm-hmm. So you have to plan for that. Things like that. You have to be careful about what kind of water is going to be washing into wetlands where you have protected species. Mm-hmm. There are certain plants that don't do well if they have physical disturbance of the soil, and they're threatened and endangered species that don't do well if there's physical disturbance. On the other hand, a lot of them require fire for reproduction. Mm-hmm. So you have some
plants require fire?
Yes, absolutely.
How does that work? For
example, there's a common type of grass that you have in flatwoods and in sandhill habitats, and it's called wiregrass. It's okay. Aristida stricta is the scientific name. And it requires periodic fire to reproduce by seed successfully. Okay. So if you don't have fire within regular intervals, it can't reproduce successfully. The clumps will stay there, but they'll slowly shrink over time until they're just not very many.
So the fire releases the...
The fire stimulates the seeds to reproduce. That's
okay.
Correct. There's a lot of plants like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Either the direct heat from the fire does it,
mm-hmm.
or the change in the soil chemistry from the ash as it washes into the soil convinces the plants that it's time for them to germinate. And so, and you have the seeds in the seed bank, mm-hmm. all right? So the seed bank, for those who don't know, is basically that area of the surface of the soil that contains seeds of various mm-hmm. species. Now, as we know, heat rises. So fire comes through, most of the heat goes up, but you'll still get some radiant heat that'll heat the surface of the soil. And that will convince some of those seeds that, hey, a fire's come through. I now have no competition. It's time for me to germinate.
That's interesting.
Yes. And each species of seed will have a half-life. Mm-hmm. In other words, after a certain period of time, half of the seeds of this species that have been deposited in the soil will be dead. The other half will still be viable. Okay. And sometimes those half-lives are very short, like less than a year, depending on the species. Some of those half-lives can be 30 or 40 years or even more. Where
really?
These seeds can sit in the soil and be viable. That's absolutely true. It's amazing.
Wow.
There's a plant called clasping warrior, okay. Warrior amplexifolia, and it is an endangered species, and I worked with this plant when I worked for Seminole State Forest in Lake County.
Okay.
And there's a tract called the warrior tract, named after the plant, mm-hmm. Southeast of Claremont. It's 120 acres, and it is the last big patch of sandhill and scrub in that area of the Lake Wales Ridge. All the rest has been turned into McMansions and citrus
Aww.
Groves and
mm.
and cattle pasture.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was overgrown with oaks because it had no fire for a long time. And they did a survey back in, I guess it was 2003, 2004, and they found less than 100 of these plants germinating, less than 100 in the whole 120 acres,
mm-hmm.
right? We instituted a program of reducing the oaks, meaning we killed a bunch of the overgrown oaks. They came up from the roots, which was a problem because no one had planned for that, which they should have. That was before me, so I'm not responsible for that. But then we did a series of prescribed burns. Mm-hmm. So that in 2016, when we did a survey of these plants, I was leading this survey. We did a survey and went throughout the whole thing. We found over 8,900 of them had germinated.
Oh, my goodness.
In areas that had not seen this plant in 40 years.
Huh.
Okay? So it went from less than 100 or around 100, I can't remember exact numbers now, in 2003, I think, to 2016 after we'd done the oak reduction and we'd done about two or three prescribed fires,
mm-hmm.
up to 8,900 plus individual plants that had germinated and were reproducing.
That's insane.
It is crazy. And this was in areas that had not had plants for 40 years.
Yeah.
But the seeds are still there in the seed bank and still viable.
How deep are the seeds in the seed bank? Does it vary?
It does vary. It tends not to be particularly deep because, you know, a seed falls on the ground and mm-hmm. it stays there on top of the ground and it doesn't work its way down. So maybe within the top 2 or 3 inches, deer and feral hogs and human beings will come by and tromp on the soil and sometimes they'll work their way down a little farther. Mostly it stays up there on top. But the other thing that happens is when you have these seeds down there, you also have the needle cast from the pines and the oak litter from the oaks. And these fall on top of these leaves of these seeds and sit there on top of them. And that gets thicker and thicker and thicker over time. So they just can't germinate because they have all this stuff on top of them. But come through with prescribed fire, and that burns off, and suddenly these seeds are like, yay, now's my chance. I'm going to shine.
Yeah, it's my turn to shine.
Right.
I'm thinking back, even growing my own milkweed, I think milkweed seeds are a little bit the opposite. They require some cold first before they...
Yes.
They germinate.
Yes. There's a couple of seeds that require things like scarification.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
Scarification is when a seed has to have its outer cuticle damaged to some degree in some way. And some ways it has to be roughed up, you know, roughed so that the water can seep into it. Other times it's acids that will eat into it. So, for example, a lot of seeds much prefer to germinate after they've passed through a bird's gut. So the bird comes up, eats the berry or whatever, swallows the seed. Seed gets into the crop. Mm-hmm. There's little stones in the crop that the bird has swallowed to help grind up things, and it grinds up the food and it roughs up the seed. And then it passes in the bird's stomach where the digestive acids are in there, and that affects the seed as well. And then the bird flies off, and a couple hours later, it comes back out of the bird, brought by a different route, and lands on the ground. And now it's all set to germinate. All it needs is a little bit of water. There are certain seeds, certain plants, in fact, lots of them in the world that require passing through a bird's gut before they can germinate. There's others where it helps. It's not necessary, but it helps. It increases the likelihood of germination. And so if you're at home and you have one of these seeds, well, you either buy yourself a chicken and feed it to them, or you take it and you dump it in some kind of thing that's going to soften the surface. Like sometimes it'll be nitric acid or vinegar. I knew a fellow who was doing elytra seeds for sale plants. He was creating more seeds, native seeds, to give to people, but he had to get more seeds by having a lot germinate in his greenhouse. And so he took the seeds and he put them in a bag, a Ziploc bag with a bunch of bleach. Mm-hmm. And what he said is he shaked and baked it. So he took these elytra seeds and just shook the bag up for like a minute.
Oh, wow.
And then dumped them out and dried them out, and he had 100% germination from it. 100%.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. And so the other thing you can do at home is some people get a Dremel, and they Dremel the surface of the seed and so forth. But it really depends on the species, and you have to know the species, because some species don't like that. Mm-hmm. Other species do like it, and some species require it.
Ralph, I also know that not only are you greatly involved with our controlled fires, but you are also our tour guide for a lot of our walks in the park that we do here in Flagler County. I recently walked with you, and it was a very informative walk. I also had someone, a little bird, tell me that you were responsible for vouchering a lot of species here in the county. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Flagler County is... I discovered pretty quickly from looking at range maps of things, different things, birds and mammals and amphibians and plants, that Flagler is kind of a herp gap. Herps are as herpetologists.
What's herpetology?
Herpetology. Herps are herp means low.
Okay.
And it refers to creatures that are low on the ground and therefore refers to reptiles and amphibians.
Okay.
So a herpetologist is someone who studies reptiles and amphibians. And so the general common term for reptiles and amphibians in the academia is herps. So Flagler County has a herp gap, and it also has a plant gap, because apparently nobody in the distant past, when it was really, really big to go out and find new plants and new amphibians, came here. So there's a fellow named Archie Carr, who is a very famous Florida biologist. He was at the University of Florida in Gainesville and went all over the place collecting plant samples and various other things. And he took other biologists with him too. He took herpetologists with him and ornithologists, and they all went out, and all the graduate students go out, and he'd go and find things and voucher them. And voucher means taking a sample of it or taking a photo of it at a particular location, recording that location, and the date and the circumstances and the habitat it was in.
So proving it's here.
Basically proving it's there. That's what a voucher is. In the past, it always required a physical sample. So if you went out and you found the last living...
skunk ape?
Well, that's the last living skunk ape. You know, you'd shoot it, and then you'd drive it back to Gainesville, where it could be a skin could be repaired and it could be stuck in a big drawer and with a date on it, a tag on it.
You
so,
didn't vouch for a skunk.
No, I'm not yet. I'm working on it. I'm sure I'll find one soon. But anyway, the point is that, that I found there was all sorts of really common things that just had not been vouchered for the county. And so I said, well, I'm going to be vouchering them then if I can find them. I don't have to usually do a lot of searching. I'm just out there doing my normal work and I'll see things because that's my skill is not necessarily knowing something ahead of time. Some things I do, but a lot of things I don't know ahead of time, I just know what's unusual. I say, that looks different and I'll see that and I'll go take a photo of it and I'll get collect information on it and get a location and remember where it is. Sometimes things are threatened or endangered and you don't want to pull them up. Other things, I know they're not, and I'll just, you know, bring a sample. And then that, I'll have a plant. And then I'll take that plant and I'll press it and preserve it the old-fashioned way, the way my grandmother used to do, which is put it in a big, heavy book between two pieces of paper towel and until it's dry. And then I'll send it off to either the University of South Florida's Plant Atlas, Florida Plant Atlas at their herbarium, or... since they don't have a curator now, I sent it off to the University of Florida in Gainesville to the museum there, the Florida Museum, where one of the curators is Ellen Frank, who's a really brilliant guy, and he takes this stuff and he'll preserve it. So that we'll have a record of these plants occurring in Flagler County. Right now, I'm at about 30, 32 or so new plants that had never been vouchered before. Some of it's really common stuff. Like, remember I told you about wiregrass earlier? No one had vouchered wiregrass. I don't know why. But I had this idea that Archie Carr, coming east from Gainesville, the University of Florida, got as far as Ocala National Forest with lots of natural stuff. And so they went through there and they found this plant, they found that plant, they found this reptile, and they found this mammal and all this stuff. And then at the end of the day, they found that between them and Flagler County was Lake George and the St. John's River. And they're like, we don't need to go over there. We're just going to head into Palatka,
right,
find a nice little pub, have a couple of good Pilsners, and drive back to Gainesville.
Oh, dear.
And that's probably accurate what happened, because Flagler College is to the north, Stetson College is to the south in two different counties, and University of Florida is way to the west. So they just never got here, or very few did. And so since then, I've also vouchered seven species of herps in the county. So,
well, you have kind of a sixth sense when it comes to that. You were telling me a story about the newts.
Yeah, my wife says I have a sixth sense too. Sixth. Sorry,
yes,
my mistake. Both are accurate, by the way.
Okay, good. Good to know.
So yeah, I see things. I see things move, and I know what most of the herps are. At least I can know what they might be. And so I'll say, all right, well, I'll take a look at this. And there's a number of people who've done books who show the ranges that have not been here. One of them's a good friend of mine, Kevin Enge. He's with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Service out of Gainesville, in their wildlife lab, their herpetology lab. He's a really smart guy. He's the fellow who discovered that there were not just one species of alligator snapping turtle, but that there were at least three and probably four different species of alligator snapping turtle.
Really?
Right. And so he did papers on them back 10 or so years ago to demonstrate this. He collected the genetics on them and the morphological data and the fact that they were in different watersheds and so forth, which is, you know, a pretty big deal. Anyway, he... I've worked with him since probably about 2008, 2009, on and off on various things. But a lot of it was with the striped newt. So the striped newt, Notothalmus peristriatus. Peristriatus means part stripe because the adults have a double stripe on their back that's broken. And so it's called the striped newt, is a threatened species in Florida. Because its populations in general are dropping, mostly because of habitat loss, but also because of disease, and some other reasons that we don't know about, and so he keeps track of where these populations of striped newts are, and back in October of 2022, when I first got here to Flagler County, I was up at Princess Place Preserve. And where there's a number of ephemeral and semi-permanent and permanent ponds. And someone had found a gopher frog up there. Well, gopher frogs used to be threatened, but they're not anymore because we've found a lot of them, more than we thought.
Maybe they were hiding.
Well, I was kind of part of that. I didn't mean to be. I didn't mean to be, but when I was at Seminole State Forest, when I got there in 2006, they had one documented breeding pond for gopher frogs. Mm-hmm. When I left, through my efforts and the efforts of others who I'd cooperated with, and Kevin Enge included, which I asked him to come out and help me, we had 23 breeding ponds.
Oh, wow.
All right. Now, that's not because they decided to start breeding more ponds. We just happened to find them here in more ponds. Because let's say you go to a pond once and you dip it and there's no amphibians in there. You use a dip net to pull it out and look for the larvae. And you're like, oh, there's none in there. And then you don't give up. Mm-hmm. Because just because they're not there today doesn't mean they won't be there next year. Mm. So if you think there's a possibility of them there, you just keep going back to the pond. And suddenly, you know, like there's one pond, I dipped it twice before, hadn't found anything. The third time went out there, I found over 120 gopher frog larvae in half an hour of dipping. So, yeah. Anyway, so we had 23. So the gopher frog was found up there at Princess Place Preserve, and I'd seen one, and I said, well, we better figure out where they're breeding. Mm-hmm. And there's one big pond there. And so I got my dip net and my waders and my clipboard with my form on it, and I go walking towards the pond, and I say to myself, you know, wouldn't it be great if there were striped newts in here? Because striped newts and gopher frogs tend to breed in the same type of wetlands.
I often think that when I'm walking in the woods.
Yeah, of course. Everyone does. Everyone thinks the same thing. So I'm like, wouldn't it be great if I found a striped newt in the same pond? That would be funny. Ha, 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 ha. Right. So I get down there. First dip, gopher frog larvae. I'm like, all right, good. We've confirmed where we are. Second dip, striped newt.
Boom.
Boom, just like that. And since then, with Kevin Enge's help organizing and going out and my dipping on my own, we now have, I think, 10 ponds on Princess Place Preserve. Now, Princess Place Preserve, I think, is like 1,500 acres.
Okay. I don't know.
Yeah, 1,500 acres, that's roughly. Deep. It's 1,500 acres. Mm-hmm. And in that, we found 10 gopher frog breeding ponds over the last 2.5 years.
Holy moly.
Not gopher frogs, excuse me, striped newt breeding ponds. Mm-hmm. We've got 3 gopher frog breeding ponds, but 10 striped newt breeding ponds. And some of them is like just bazillions of them. Kevin Enge has always said, and he says striped newts are really hard to find because you can't find the adults. The adults have very low detectability. It's only the larvae. So you need to go out there when the larvae are out there. So we're out of this one pond that mm-hmm. I just found and brought him out to confirm that I'd found them. And so we bought a bunch of guys out there. We're all mm-hmm. dipping away, and we had found like 12 of the adults.
Oh, really? Okay,
in this little teeny-weeny pot, like 12. So yeah. I said, so, Kevin, I said, adults are hard to find, are they? And he says, yeah, but you have a bunch load of newts.
Yeah.
Bunch wasn't the word
you
used.
Yeah, I know.
just saying. Right. Yeah. And at another pond where I'd gone out, it's a cypress swamp with a pond cypress growing out of it. And it's about, I think, 13 acres or so, 11 to 13 acres of size, depending how flooded it is. And I said, Josh, I wonder if there's any striped newts in there. I'll go check. So I go out there, and again, first dip, I get a pig frog larvae, which is cool. Second dip, I get a striped newt. I'm like, all right, great. I confirm they're here. It was only like 5 minutes of dipping. And
so
I was
basically overrun by striped newts here in
Flagler County. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Right. So anyway, so I just found the one. So when Kevin came out to dip the pond, and I said, and I told him to go dip it. I said, yeah. I said, it's really cool. We've got them in there. He says, well, you know, Ralph, it was probably only one. And you just got really lucky. You know, it wasn't like you were being smart or brilliant or anything. I'm like, all right. So me and him and 2 other people, so 4 of us out there dipped for like, I think like 10 minutes, mm-hmm. And we found 10 newts, right? In this 100 feet of shoreline, we found 10 of them. So I said, so Kevin, I was just lucky, eh? And he says, nah, there's so many newts in here, it'd be hard for you not to find one, so I still don't respect you.
Oh, it's good to have nice friends.
Yeah, he's great. Oh, when everyone comes out, whenever I do striped newt dipping, I get a bunch of a couple of boxes of Fig Newtons, mm-hmm. and a couple of boxes of Nutella. Oh. And the first person who finds a newt gets a box of Fig Newtons.
Okay.
The person who finds the most newts gets a box of Fig Newtons. And the person who gets the coolest newt gets a box of Nutella.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I'm weird that way.
No puns intended.
Anyway, so getting back to this. So, and then between us and Pellissier property, Pellissier, mm-hmm. preserve next door. Mm-hmm. As it's about 2,000 acres total. They also have a bunch of newt ponds because we figured they would, and so we mm-hmm. dipped those too. And so we're at 16 striped newt ponds. As in, before I got here in 2022, there were zero that we knew of. Now we have 16 within these two preserves put together for 2,000 acres. This makes us the third most populous striped newt population anywhere in the world.
Oh, wow.
After Ocala National Forest, which has 360,000 acres, mm-hmm. and Jennings State Forest, which I think has like 26,000 acres.
Oh, wow.
And so we've got, because one of them has like 30 ponds, the other has like 18, and we're at 16 with only 2,000 acres of property between.
Holy herpetology, Batman.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So anyway, so and since then I found a couple of other things that are cool. Some of the very common stuff. We have now we have the most southerly record of bronze frog in the coastal Florida is that we now have. This was down on the Bulow property that we have just south of 100. I just found that about a year and a half ago. So, which is also really cool. So,
are those a protected species?
They're not a protected species, but we just don't always know how far things go. You can only record in the literature what is known.
Yeah.
You know, speculation about where it could be doesn't help.
Exactly.
You can say it might be there, but you can't say it is just because mm-hmm. you want it to be. So it has to be confirmed by someone finding it. And so that's what vouchering is, so that we can confirm where things are and hopefully protect them.
In your vouchering, do you encounter a lot of invasive species?
We are overflowing with the invasive species in Florida, not mm-hmm. just Flagler County. It's not mm-hmm. just us. It's everywhere. We have a really big problem with Brazilian pepper. Brazilian pepper has been here since the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And
how did it get here?
Someone brought it in because they thought it looked cool. this happens a lot. Mm-hmm. Like the water hyacinth, someone mm-hmm. brought it in from Louisiana. Someone had it at an expo in Louisiana in the 1880s. And they brought it to Florida and put it in their pond in the backyard because they thought it looked cool. And then it grew like mad and covered their entire pond. And they were next to the Suwannee River. So they said, oh, we'll just put it in the river. Yeah, great. But, you know, people don't know. They didn't know back then, certainly, but it became a big problem. Now it's mostly under control because of biological controls. There's some creatures, some insects from its native range that eat it, and they don't eat stuff native to Florida. So you bring those insects in, they eat the water hyacinth and it reduces numbers. So combining that with physical control, mechanical control of pulling it out of things, it's mostly under control now in Florida.
What do you do if you encounter, what did you call it, Brazilian pepper?
Brazilian pepper, it's all over the place. It's all along the coast, right between the mangroves and the coastal hardwood hammock. Mm-hmm. It's just ubiquitous. It's all over the place. And it crowds out everything else. It reduces the species diversity and complexity in there. It's not as good for everything. And it's got a problem is that birds love eating the seeds. Mm. So robins will just chow down on those seeds.
Back
to the dang birds. I love the birds. It's not their fault, but that's what they do. And so it spreads all over the place. It's not too terribly difficult to kill. Mm-hmm. Except there's so much of it, it requires a lot of effort. And so for right now, we are trying in land management to kill as much of it as possible, to open up the areas and make them more natural. Mm-hmm. We have some volunteers that do this, like the Friends of Betty Steflick are also helping us at Betty Steflick Park to eliminate as much of the Brazilian pepper there as we can. And we're doing a pretty good job now. We're getting a roll on it. It involves a lot of mechanical thing, cutting it with chainsaws and handsaws, and then spraying the stump with a herbicide called Garlon.
Okay. Does that hurt the other vegetation?
It does not if you do it right, but that's the whole point. You get licensed to do it. You read the label. You have to read the label on the product, and these mm-hmm. are complicated labels, but you have to understand them, and you only use the product when and where on a species that it'll be effective at so that it doesn't spread. Herbicides, just like seeds, have a half-life. There's a certain amount of time they will persist in the environment before they break down into other products.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so you want to do things in a way where you're not going to have so much of it out there. It's going to be a problem. You want to put it in specific things. For example, on the Brazilian pepper, what we do generally is cut stumps. So you cut the thing down at the base, and let's say the thing is about 2 or 3 inches across, mm-hmm. and then you spray the Garlon on there right on top of that stump and no place else. And it'll get pulled down into the roots by the plant system. and kill it, and then it'll break down and it doesn't cause a problem. But you don't want to go willy-nilly just spraying it all over the place. You have to do it, and we've got to be safe with it.
Yeah.
So we wear our goggles. Mm-hmm. We wear our protective rubber gloves that are 15 mil thickness minimum. Mm-hmm. We wear a long sleeve shirt, and we carry it in a safe way, and we keep it away from everyone who doesn't know how to use it. And we are cautious, 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 because safety first.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as like herpetology, talking about the amphibians and reptiles, are we overrun with invasive species?
We have some invasive species. Yes, there's in our area there are two harps that are there's actually three that are in the area, but one of them's not really much of a problem. It's a little thing about I was going to hold up my fingers and show how long it is, but this doesn't work without a camera. So I'm going to say they get to about 6 or 7 inches long max. Okay. It's called the Bremini blind snake.
Okay.
And it looks like a little brown worm because it's uniform all the way across. And it was brought in the plant industry for importing potted plants.
Okay.
And it's ubiquitous now everywhere, but it's a very small little thing. It just eats a larvae of ants and termites.
Well, I like that.
Yeah. And it's small, teeny weeny, harmless, can't even bite you, and it doesn't seem to cause a problem. But it's very, very common. The other two are common in the area are the Cuban anole or brown anole, which is Anola sagrii.
The brown lizards?
Yeah, the little brown ones you have in your brown anole, Cuban anole, either mm-hmm. way is good. Now, they have been here also for a very long time, and they're very common in urban areas, but you'll also find them in natural areas. Mm-hmm. And it used to be thought that they were eliminating and exterminating locally, which is local extinction, right, is called extirpation. So okay. It's locally extirpated. The green anoles. But it turns out that's not the case.
Is that where the green anoles started?
Yes. What happened was a principle in biology and ecology called niche partitioning.
Okay.
So a niche or niche, mm-hmm. however you want to pronounce it, is the area, the type of circumstances where a organism lives. So it includes the physical environment it is in, it includes the other biotic components like plants and other animals, mm-hmm. it includes temperature, and weather and moisture and the physical extent of the area, how big an area it is, and where it lives within all of this, mm-hmm. and the food it eats and so forth. That's its niche, and it's very specific to an organism. Now, some organisms have very broad niches, like human beings have very mm-hmm. broad niches.
Yeah.
We can eat almost anything. We can live almost anywhere. Mm-hmm. But some of them have very narrow niches. But some of species have broader niches than they critically need to survive because there's nothing competing with them.
Mm-hmm.
So if something comes in and competes with them, they can be squeezed out of part of their niche rather than the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on with the brown anole and the Cuban anole.
Okay.
So the brown anole naturally lives from ground level up to about 5 or 6 feet above the ground on trees and plants and things. And that's mm-hmm. where you see them in your yard. Well, the green anole used to live from the ground up to the tops of trees.
Mm-hmm.
But when the brown anole came in, it squeezed the green anole higher up into the trees. So once it's above 6 feet above the ground, you don't generally see them because mm-hmm. we human beings are how tall maximum?
Yeah, about 6 feet.
Right. So we just didn't see them anymore. They were there. They were just – their niches went higher into the vegetation and on the sides of houses and things.
That's so interesting.
Right. And so they've worked out this arrangement naturally, ecologically. Between the two species where the brown anoles have the ground and the green anoles have from 6 feet up, and they're both still doing fine.
Yeah, I would imagine. So then they'd have even different predators, right? Because then you'd have
right,
more potentially. Brown ones for the brown ones.
That's a very good observation. I don't know if that is true. I have not seen that, and I have not seen any studies published on it, but it is important to think about that. Mm-hmm. It makes sense that you would find that terrestrial predators would be more likely to eat the brown anoles now, mm-hmm. And arboreal predators would be more likely to eat the green anoles. That
very
makes perfectly good sense.
In my head, it does.
Very good. No, very good. I'm going to give you a gold star for that. You get a gold star for that.
I just remember.
I'll give you another Kit Kat later.
Yeah, there you go.
Yay.
No Nutella, but a Kit Kat.
Yeah, yeah, more sugar. Yay, diabetes.
Fun.
And then the other species is the Cuban tree frog. which is spreading in Florida. Mostly it was in urban areas, but now it's spreading into natural areas. And it is a real problem because it will eat any other amphibians it can find.
Oh, really?
Yes. That's why you generally cannot find in urban areas now, you generally cannot find any of the native tree frogs. You don't find green tree frogs or pinewoods tree frogs or squirrel tree frogs in urban areas anymore. Very rarely, only in areas where there's enough natural vegetation that they can escape the Cuban tree frogs. And which is sad because they used to be, again, ubiquitous in our yards. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was a kid in St. Petersburg, I first got there in 1971. And in the summer of 72, I went to a summer camp with my church. We'd go off every morning to Eckerd College. Mm-hmm. And Eckerd College had a big swimming pool. And so all we kids would get to go out there and swim in the swimming pool. And I'd come from Omaha, Nebraska, where they have zero tree frogs. And so we got there, and the green tree frogs would be living in the poles that held up the lifeguard seats because the poles were open on the top, the aluminum poles, and they'd fill with water, and the tree frogs would just sit down in there. And I remember catching every day. Aww. Instead of going out and going swimming, I'd go out there and catch some green tree frogs and play with them for a little while before I went swimming, which is really cool. Well, not anymore. The whole of the Pinellas Peninsula is filled up with Cuban tree frogs. You might find them in, there's a couple of parks there, like there's a around Lake Maggiore, there's a natural area in St. Petersburg that might still have some of the native tree frogs. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some because it's natural enough.
Yeah.
But in DeLand, where I live, no, you can't find any native tree frogs. You can Cuban tree frogs everywhere, but no native ones. You have to get out to the edges of town where you've got more ditches and flat woods and pine flatwoods and swamps before you find the native tree frogs.
Everyone loves listening to your stories and learning more about like our natural flora and fauna in our lovely county. And one wonderful thing that you do is you actually, back to what I was talking about earlier in the podcast, you are a tour guide for our free walk in the woods or walk in the park series that we do. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so we started this back in 2020, may have been late 2022, I can't remember now. But my former boss, Mike Lagacy, wanted us to do these little tours out in the woods. And he called it Walk in the Park in the Woods, which is actually a very clever name, but it's kind of long.
Are you sure he didn't just send you to the woods and then you found your way back?
Well, you know, I hadn't thought about that, but now thinking about it, it's probably true. It's probably true. You know, I just wandered around. I have a great sense of direction. That's what's going on. I mean, he didn't know that,
though. Yeah.
it was a very cool name, Walk in the Park in the Woods. But we kept forgetting whether it was Walking in the Woods in the Park or whatever. And it's just too unmanageable, a long name. So now it's just a Walk in the Woods to make it easier. And what we'd do is once a month, we'd go out and find one of the natural areas that we manage for land management, one of the parks, and we'd just go for a walk. Take a hike, and I'd tell people what I knew and what I didn't know. I'd make up creative lies if necessary about plants and animals and history and archaeology and habitats and all that stuff, all the interesting stuff that people seem to find very cool. And since I have a lot of experience in Florida with natural areas and with the various species, I'm mostly an ornithologist. I was the scrub jay biologist for Seminole State Forest for 16 years, like I said, which is Florida's only endemic bird, only found in Florida. Only bird that's only found in Florida is the Florida scrub jay. Don't forget that. There'll be a quiz later. It'll be worth 30% of your grade, okay? So take notes. So I spent my years on Seminole State Forest, and this is where I learned most of the plant and animal stuff that I know. And it was part of my job. And so I have awareness of a lot of these things. So it made sense that I would be the one doing it. But at the time, they didn't know what a potty mouth I was. So this causes problems. Well, I try not to be, but they slip out now and
again. So you try to do these tours during the cooler months.
Yeah, because, you know, people don't need to be miserable. And besides, even though I'm the guy who likes going out and doing this stuff, even I would not sign up for one in mid-July, okay? No. I just wouldn't.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, we'd get like 20 yards from the parking lot and everyone would say, it's too hot, go back to the cars and we're done.
So, if people are interested in going on one of these walk walks in the park, in the woods with you. Mm-hmm. What should they wear? What should they bring with them?
Well, it's I have a list of stuff that is always, Flagler County does an excellent job of advertising this stuff in the Flagler County media.
Yes,
and so you all can go there and look it up if you're, anyone's interested.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do one per month, but this year we're starting to try to do two per month.
Mm-hmm.
And this will go through at least into early April before it gets too miserable. We limit it to 8 people because for safety reasons, because you're wandering out in the woods with people that I don't know and I don't know their ability. And it's hard to keep track of more than 8 people at a time. So we keep limited to 8 people. Maybe later on, if I can bring one of my cohorts in, but my cohorts are very busy doing other stuff.
Yes.
We can even double that to 16 if we have like 2 people leading. But you really can't keep track of more than 8 people at a time, at least not safely. So, but I'll tell you the things you need to do if you're doing this, as you should always do if you're walking in natural areas in Florida, is you should wear closed-toed shoes, long pants.
Yes.
Sunglasses or something for your eyes if you're worried about glaucoma and and all that stuff from ultraviolet radiation. A hat to keep your head covered. Sunscreen to keep yourself from getting skin cancer. Bug spray if you want to keep the mosquitoes off of you and gnats and other things. A lot of these things aren't critical, but they're important. But if you have trouble walking, carry a walking stick. If you're worried about your feet getting wet, make sure you have rubber boots or waterproof boots, though we usually don't take people out where they're going to get wet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, someone might get enthusiastic. You never know. Like,
yeah.
Ooh, look, there's a feather out there in the estuary. I'm going to go get it.
The estuary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Water.
Water.
That's
right. Bring a life vest. No. And water. Most importantly, water, because it's very easy to get dehydrated in Florida, even in winter, because you think, it's winter. It's now where I'm not going to go through a lot of heat. Well, you put on a bunch of sweaters because you think it's going to be cold, and it turns out it's not as cold, but you don't want to take the sweater off, or you don't notice because you're schlepping along with me and my jaw's flapping, so you forget that you're overheated. And then you get overheated, and you get dehydrated, and maybe you get heat exhaustion. Well, heat exhaustion in itself is not generally a dangerous condition. Just you feel a little nauseous and you feel really sweaty and you need to go sit under a tree, which is fine. But if not taken care of, it can turn into heat stroke. And heat stroke is a deadly thing. It can kill people. The way to avoid heat stroke is A, not get overheated, and B, drink lots of water, because that's how human beings stay cool, through sweat. Some people don't like to sweat. Tough. You're in Florida.
Yep.
You need to sweat so that you don't die if you're in the woods. Right? And so I tell everyone, drink a lot of water before you go. Carry water with you if you can. Please do. It's just safety first in Florida. You've got to be aware of these things.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, if you're interested out there to do one of these walks in the park in the woods with Ralph or a member of his team.
Just walk in the woods now. Just walk in the woods.
Walk in the woods now.
Which is too bad because I got to say, it was a really clever name, but it's just too.
That's a lot of words.
It's just too much to handle. Yeah, so we just keep it a walk in the woods.
But just follow us on social media. We're constantly posting when his next one is, or you can find that out on our website as well. I think if you just click on find a park in our Parks and Rec section on our website. Right. So we're always 2 weeks in advance of advertising for the walks in the park.
Yeah.
So.
Walk in the woods.
Walk in the woods.
Dang.
Foiled again.
No, sorry, you're going to fail the quiz. I just know it.
Scrub Jays.
Yeah. Just say the word Scrub Jays and I give you a
newt.
Pass. Yeah.
Stripe Newt.
There
Scrub
you go.
Jays.
There you go. You pass.
Well, Ralph, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us about your niche.
My niche.
So thank you. So thanks for listening. Until next time.